Good evening, everybody. On behalf of Indira Gandhi National Center for the Arts and Project Mausam, I welcome you all to this evening's lecture by Professor Abdulaziz Yusuf. Professor Yusuf is is currently a professor in Swahili with Comparative Bantu and East African Area Studies since November 2008 with Department of Linguistics and Philology, Uppsala. He has published several books. He's been quoted extensively in international publications. He's a scholar on East African studies and so many other disciplines following. He has language skills in Swahili, English, Swedish, Gujarati, Hindi, Arabic, French, German. He's a multilingual truly. And this lecture is being held under Project Mausam, which covers the nations in the Indian Ocean. So, in that, East Africa is a very crucial, the relation between India and East Africa, the trade route becomes a very crucial part. I now invite Professor Aziz to deliver the lecture.
Thank you for inviting me here to start with. I am quite honored for being given this opportunity. This is a topic that has been of great interest. Recently, the interest has been increasing. The place of the Indian Ocean and the Indian Ocean as a corridor, as we call it, especially the northwestern. And we also talk about the rim of the Indian Ocean. But that's not including all the islands, especially the eastern part, what used to be called the East Indies, Indonesia, Malaysia, and going further. So it would be better to call it the Indian Ocean world, which would include both the eastern African coast, the northern parts of the Indian Ocean, the Red Sea, the Gulf area, and both the eastern and western coastal areas of the Indian subcontinent, and going further all the way to the Philippines. I would like to first read a paragraph or two as the introduction to my presentation. Since April 2013, a sensational story has been reported of five copper coins originating in the Tanzanian island of Kilwa, believed to date back to the 1100s, found in a remote part of northern Australia. In 1944, towards the end of the Second World War, some coins were found by a soldier on an isolated island. And these coins were later analyzed and proved to be from possibly 1600s together with some Dutch coins. And there were two coins from East Africa, from Kilwa. These are the coins from 1100, the middle of 1100. Kilwa is in ruins today. It was a major port, probably the largest port on the coast of East Africa, and it was dealing with all the way to in China. There are so many details in this, and I will try to avoid them, but some of the details may be given when you ask questions or give comments. These coins, five were identified as coming from Kilwa in this collection. And the city-state of Kilwa, founded by the Shirazi from Persia, who had arrived there in 975, had established polities along the coast. There are a lot of legends about the ruler of Shiraz who had run away because of the civil war in Iran when the Shias were expanding and coming to the coast. Kilwa became the major center, and for a long time Kilwa dominated until the coming of the Portuguese. Finally, the Portuguese sacked Kilwa, and in 1505 they destroyed the Sultanate. In 1506 there was an Indian from Dabol, you call it today, we call it Daibul. It's a port, and it was a city-state. It's halfway between Bombay and Goa. Dabol is still there, and it was a major port on the western coast of India. The man was called Muhammad, Haji Muhammad Rukn al-Din, and he had the Arabized surname al-Dabuli, which was the practice among the Muslims. They would use the name of the place they are coming from as the surname or something like that. He was installed in Kilwa as the sultan by the Portuguese, but only for a year or two. And then people started deserting Kilwa, and it has never since recovered. This is what it looks like today. You can see the Indian influence also in the architecture. This is the old town and the large palaces and forts and fortifications. This big one is called Husuni Kubwa, the great beauty, one can say, and the other one further away near the sea there is called Husuni Ndogo. These are the hammams there. The baths, Persian baths with steam and all that. There are holes in, made in the ground like small bathtubs and so on. I will show you this and comment that similar ones are found in Zanzibar, right in the middle of the Zanzibar so-called stone town where I come from. And even the street is called Hamamni, it means at the Hamam, which is a museum today, and part of the Zanzibar archives. The Hamams in Zanzibar are from the beginning of the 1800s when one princess from Tehran, the daughter of Muhammad Ali Shah, she was called Shahrazade, like in the 1001 Nights. She was married to the Sultan of Oman, and she came to Zanzibar in 1839. And similar palaces were built there also, which are still surviving, with an upper floor and a system of collecting rainwater and letting it run down into pools and all that, which still survive. This is also an old coin. There's a similar coin from China found recently, which is about from the 6th century, it is claimed. And about 500 coins were found towards the end of the 1800s in the south of Zanzibar Island. Gold coins, during the time Dr. David Livingstone was there. Some of the coins have been kept in the museums in Europe. Most of them were smelted. One more coin was found in 1993 when those areas were re-excavated. These are Roman coins. It doesn't mean the Romans were there or that the East Africans had been to Rome, but gold and silver coins, they change hands and they survive many, many generations. It shows either, if not direct, then at least indirect trade between the southernmost parts of the
the coast of Mozambique is not included here, unfortunately. But this is the southern part of Tanzania. This is the central part up to the north of Tanzania. And then the southern part of Kenya, coming all the way up to the northern part here, and then the Somali coast. All this is what we call the Swahili coast. But the Swahili coast goes further down, all the way to Maputo, almost to the border of between Mozambique and South Africa. The name Mogadishu is also a Swahili name. It means a city in the eyes, which means a beautiful city, which it is not anymore today. As you can see, there are so many places which have been excavated, more than 250 urban areas during different periods, from very early in the first millennium, that's from around the year 600 after Christ, coming all the way up to the 18th, 19th centuries of our time. Even on the islands, you see a lot of urban centers. And here, we have the oldest functioning building from 1107. It is a mosque. And the inscription on the mosque is in Kufic Arabic, engraved in stones. Of course, the mosque has been built, rebuilt several times, but the foundation is from 1107. This is also proof of that Islam was established quite early, and it had spread all over the Indian Ocean, over the coastlines. And almost all coastal settlements in the Indian Ocean, all the way going down to Vietnam, they had Muslim towns, villages, even fishing villages became Muslim, which you can find today even in Cambodia. There are some villages with Muslims, and they wrote different languages in the Arabic script. So Arabic became the international language of trade. The majority of the people behind in the hinterland were not Muslim. They were still Hindus or Buddhists or tribals, but the ruling elites everywhere became Muslim. And they were intermarrying with one another and having trade connections. The same family would have one son in East Africa, another son in India, a daughter married in Java, and so on and so forth. And this continues even today with many old merchant houses, especially the Shia, the Bohra, the Khoja, the Ismailis. They still do it. And to some extent, the Sunnis do it also. where are we now? Sorry. So, these are the major centers we have in East Africa, which had direct contacts with India. And there was a lot of trade. Goods were brought from India to East Africa and then sent all the way into the interior. And raw materials were brought to the coast, and then they were further taken to, first to India, and then sometimes from India further to different parts of Asia and to Europe through the Red Sea. One major item, and a very expensive one, was ivory. Almost all the ivory was going to India first, and until very recently, it was then re-exported after being graded from India to Europe. And it was particularly because in the Hindu custom, the women were using ivory for making bangles. And when a woman becomes a widow, she would break the bangles, which means new ivory was needed all the time. Similarly, even with slavery and slaves, as and when slaves were becoming free, new slaves were needed. And that is how the slave trade was sustained in many places. this was not just the end of this trade here. The trade was overland all the way to West Africa.
Islam had spread from West Africa, North Africa, all the way to Indonesia. Even Manila became Muslim. The ruling family became Muslim in 1565. But it survived only 5 years because the Spanish came with a big fleet and conquered most of the islands, which eventually became what is today known as the Philippines. By that time, a majority of the people, the urban people in the Philippines, were Muslim and using the Arabic script for writing the language. This was typical all over the Indian Ocean. We have trade to start with. The traders were Muslim all over. Even going into Europe, up to Bulgaria, Ibn Battuta, before he came to East Africa in 1331, January, February, he had traveled from Morocco down to what is today Guinea-Bissau. In Guinea-Bissau, even today, majority are Muslims. But it is the Christians who we see and we hear, because they have received the modern education in the mission schools. He came to Egypt and to Arabia, down the Red Sea, and to East Africa. And from East Africa, he went to the Maldives, where he stayed for 1 year and worked as the chief Qadi of the Maldives. The Maldivian language is Indo-European, it's Indic, Aryan language actually, but it is still written in the Arabic script. And the religion, Islamic religion, brought writing to many places. Many languages were written for the first time after the coming of Islam. Even Spanish itself and Portuguese, the earliest documents are still recognized to be in the Arabic script, because those languages were forbidden by the church. It was only Latin which was the written language in countries which were in one way or the other ruled by the Pope. The upper class, of course, had the right to learn how to read and write, but not the rest of the people. But the coming of Islam gave literacy even to the poor people, even the villagers, because they had to learn to read the Quran. Whereas in the Christian cultures, it was enough for the priests to be able to read and write and read the Bible to the people. The people were not supposed to read the Bible themselves. So we have the religion, which was the uniting factor, then the language, and to some extent the literature. So you find a lot of poetry from all around the Indian Ocean, which is about religious themes, and sometimes even the Islamic conquest of Damascus or Istanbul, Constantinople, and things like that, which, because they were written in the Arabic language or in the Arabic script, are considered religious, though they are not religious as such, and they were recited in the mosques and madrasas. This map shows us the major routes, trade routes. Kilimani here, it means on the hill, and Kopala, which was a gold export center. At that time, what we call Mozambique today and Zimbabwe, they were all one land, one can say. They did not have iron, instead they had a lot of gold. And the gold was brought to the coast. And most of it was, one way or the other, ending up in Arabia or India, usually in India first. And then most of it would be kept in India. Some of it would end up in Arabia later. The gold trade in Arabia started after the Nigerians started coming to Mecca with a lot of gold and bronze they had with them. And they stayed in Mecca for the first time with the king for about 2 years. And the only thing they had was to sell the gold they had And that is how the gold trade in Mecca started, which is a big trade today also. The second map here is showing other movements. Contacts with China were established, and an ambassador from Kilwa was sent to China. The Chinese at that time called East Africa as Zangistan. In Persian, it is called Zangibar. Zangi, Firdausi is mentioning in the Shahnameh, Zangi means dark brown. It doesn't mean black. It's, he says, the color of rust. And rust is not black. It is a sort of reddish brown, one could say. Today, of course, Zangi has many other connotations and derogatory terms also. In the Iranian languages, Zangi means Negro today. In Arabic, Zanji or Zinji, or, and the plural Zunuj, meaning Negro, black people. In West Africa, the Zunuj are people of low caste, those who do fishing or who work on the boats, on the rivers, on the ferries, blacksmiths, because those difficult and dirty jobs were given to slaves in their own cultures. And it was this term, Zunuj, got this connotation. We have then secondary migrations, both eastwards and westwards, and then going northwards. Much later, after the coming of the Europeans, that many more Africans started in this forced migration. But we know now through recent research that the bulk of the slaves in the Indian Ocean were not Africans. They were Asians, especially from the eastern parts, coming to the western parts. And it increased after the coming of the Europeans, especially the Portuguese, because they needed women to work in their homes, to work in their wine houses, and so on, because they were in Muslim ports and city-states where they could not get Muslim women to work in their dangure, as they call it, dancing places, which became eventually brothels. And that's why in Swahili, danguro means a brothel, coming from the Portuguese word. So it was women and children from these small and isolated islands in Indonesia, in Malaysia, where the Portuguese used to kidnap women and bring them to different places. Or young boys would be taken also and forced into the Portuguese army, work on the ships and so on. There were also laws passed later, even in Goa, that the church would take over orphans, for example. They become automatically children of the church. So that kind of slavery started after the coming of the Europeans. So I am talking about what happened before the Europeans came. They escalated the movement of people also in one way or the other. But there was this both voluntary and to some extent forced movement of people all around the Indian Ocean. I have so many details and dates and names, so I don't want to bother you with all this. We talk of the history of the Indian Ocean into periods, as the pre-Islamic period, and then the Islamic period, and then the Columbian period. So the pre-Islamic is, you may say, the Greeks and the Romans and the Persians were involved in this. Deep sea sailing started from the Persian Gulf, as we call it. Originally, it was only sailing along the coastlines, but around 700 years before Christ, the Sukan was developed, the sail, the triangular sail was developed, and then people dared to go further out in the ocean. Sailing became faster, ships became bigger, and so on. We can see also the name Sukan, that is Persian and not Arabic, but it's all around the Indian Ocean. The telescope was developed also in Iran after the glass was invented in India, in Bilaur, and so on. This
increased the presence of the Iranians here. And this was already during the Roman period. And then the Romans were defeated, and this part of the Arabian Peninsula, what we call Yemen, was freed. It was mostly Jewish at that time. And then they went all the way up to here, and a canal was built here for very shallow ships, and then further to the Mediterranean. But the Indians were traveling there already during the time of Ashoka. And Indian ambassadors were sent also to Athens all the way before our time, which is about 200 years before Christ. No, it was 500-600 years before Christ, during the Greek period and then during the Roman. And then the Romans started coming to India also. And the only thing the Romans could sell to India was silver coins, which had become standard. Today, there are about 200,000 silver coins in the museums of India. So they were brought by the millions. We don't know exactly how many. Most of them have been smelted to make jewelry and to mint Indian coins in the different countries of the Indian subcontinent. The Chinese later came to East Africa in 2 different trips. I forget the date now. And once they even the ships capsized, and the men went on land in north of Kenya, in Pate and Lamu, where recent DNA research has shown that some people from here, they are related to people in China, because the Chinese ships had were part of the royal or the imperial navy. So the names of all the captains and the sailors were written in the records of the navy there. And even their addresses, sort of, which villages they had come from. And that is how they could trace them finally and take the blood samples from those places and the blood samples from Lamu here. Let's see. Yeah. Lamu Archipelago. One island is called Lamu and the other is Pate. Okay. It was from Malindi that there was this Kachi captain, Mala. He took Vasco da Gama to Calicut. Calicut was the main port at that time. And later, these other ports rose in importance, like Dabol, also Durud, also near Zanjira. Panjim became a big port after the Portuguese settled there. What happened now, just before the Portuguese came? That I talked of the different period that we call in the history of the Indian Ocean, that we have the pre-Islamic period up to the coming of Islam. But how far can we go with that pre-Islamic period? I would suggest up to, say, the year 900, when Islam had spread sort of everywhere in the oceanic world. And it had also entered India from the north, 930s and so on. Of course, Islam had already come to the coastal areas of India.
This
all these areas here. And we see the DNA will show us how much Arab or Iranian or African blood is found among the coastal people of, from Bombay northwards, all the coasts of Gujarat, and coming up to Makran and Kutch and all that. So these people had contacts with the Arabs. And the traders, even before Islam, they were marrying one another, the trading families. So Arabs and Iranians were marrying with Indians in the coastal areas. And those areas are the ones that became Muslim long before Islam came from the north, passing through the Khyber Pass and all that. We find, for example, in Kutch, among Sunni Muslims, until very recently, Wednesday was called Arba, that is Yawmul Arba in Arabic. Thursday is called Khamis, that is Al-Khamis, the fifth day of the original Arabic week. The name Khamis is also found among the Kachi, Sunni Kachis of India. They are the only Muslims of India who use the name Khamis for a boy born on Thursday. And Juma, also Friday. Again, they are the only people, and the people of Sindh, who use Juma as a boy's name, a boy born on Friday. Incidentally, you know the name Kofi Annan. Now, Kofi is a very common name in West Africa. It simply means Friday. So any boy born on Friday would be called Kofi. And if you look at primary school books from Ghana, Nigeria, Ivory Coast, and wherever the Hausa and the Yoruba languages have spread, and the Mandinka, you will say, Kofi is a nice boy, Kofi goes to school, and so on. In East Africa, it would be Juma. Juma is a nice boy, Juma goes to school. And similarly, yeah, it was Abdul in the North African countries. Abdul is a nice boy, Abdul goes to school, and so on. This is to show that the influence of the Arabic language and the Arabic culture has very long traditions, even before the coming of the of Islam. And this made it very easy for people to intermarry, because intermarriage is very important in international trade in this context. Because there were no banks as such, so there had to be family connections for sending and receiving goods in large quantities. But after the Indians came to East Africa, there were banks there, mostly owned by the Kachis, Hindu Kachis, Muslim Kachis, and even Americans were in debt in Zanzibar at the beginning of the 1800s. Even Richard Burton and people like that had borrowed money in Zanzibar, in Zanzibari banks, and they were given checks. And that is why in the Swahili language, we have the word hundi. We have ankara, and so on, for a bill, and hundi for a check, and IOU, and things like that. Those banks have disappeared. Even the families have disappeared now, today. Even the first notes which were published were printed in East Africa, they had also Gujarati text, 5 shilling, 5 rupiah, and 10 rupiah, and so on. Much later, Hindustani came into use after the British brought North Indians and people from Bihar and very few from South India to build the railway in Kenya and Uganda, that Hindi expressions came in the restaurants, because it was Hindi and Punjabi speakers who had started the restaurant. So they would say, do chai, you see, or teen chai, and so on. But in the auction, they would use Arabic, because auction, the culture of the auction was brought from Arabia. And I understand it was also in other countries. The South Arabians settled very much in what is today Indonesia and Malaysia. They brought the architecture of building with stone and bricks. And the traders also brought the religion with them and writing. So it was in many places the same family, that the big
trading family on an island was at the same time providing a priest, because it was the major family that had spread the religion there. And ultimately they became the rulers of those small islands, and that is why we find today the aristocracy in Indonesia and Malaysia, they have South Arabian roots, and many have South Arabian, what we call Hadrami, South Yemen mostly, family names, or family names which are actually names of the places they came from. The title of this today's talk is Globalization and Early Globalization. We have to define what we mean by globalization. A simple definition would be, is any kind of communication or trade or mixing of people, spread of information and goods over large distances involving a lot of people. Now, this existed from around 1000, year 1000, up to the end of the 1500s. It existed all the way from the Atlantic to the Philippines. And the major actors in this were people who lived along the coasts, the coastlines and the islands. And in between the different ports, of course, there would be other people, some other tribals living there, but they would be rural. So they would not be counted, being rural, being non-Muslim, being not literate. They were not major actors in this. Though ultimately the goods would be bought by them, and a lot of raw materials would be brought by them to the coast or from the interior. The trade was also in the north-south direction. We are trying to develop this theory now, Professor Abdul Sharif in Zanzibar and me, that it was not just north-south along the western side of the Indian Ocean, and then the northern, what we call the northwestern Indian Ocean corridor, or what we call the rim of the Indian Ocean. It was also in the interior. Goods were coming in, coming out, but they were also moving in this direction, because they found rock crystal from Roman times in some rings, which is from South Africa. And some rings have been established to be about 100 years before Christ. So how did this rock crystal end up in Rome when it originated in South Africa? I don't mean to say that South Africans went all the way to Rome. Not necessarily. It could have come to the coastline, of course, from there all the way, it would have ended up in India or somewhere in Arabia. Finally, it ends up in Rome. And it survives as part of a ring. The normal way of traveling in the interior was on foot, of course. There were no horses in Africa at that time. In that part of Africa, even donkeys were rare. Today, we can count donkeys, quarter of a million, half a million donkeys in Tanzania, Kenya, and so on. People used to go on foot when the new moon comes, and they would walk and go as far as possible up to the full moon. And on the way, they would be leaving, selling their goods. And after at the full moon, then they would come back from there. And on their way back, they would be collecting again goods which they would have left with the people with whom they must have good relations to have some kind of trust, and they must have some kind of language to be to communicate with them. Those people whom they will meet at the end at full moon, who would then continue the journey from there, going further until the following new moon. And this is how the travel was at 14, 15 days, one can say, leg. And things, goods ended up somehow along the river, and then by river transport, goods from South Africa could have ended up all the way in Egypt and further to Europe. But the normal way was by sea, by sailing, because that is easiest and fastest. And on the way, you can stop in many places. When the Portuguese came, this was 1 year after Columbus landed, roughly 1 year in the Americas. We say it was the Columbian time, because everything changed. The new world was found. Lots of new raw materials were found, which were brought to Europe or directly to the Indian Ocean lands, vegetables and fruit and things like that, cereals, some of them, lots of beans, white beans, black beans, red beans, and so on, maize, cassava, yams, some animals also. For example, the turkey was brought also from, but that was from before Columbus crossed the Atlantic. The Columbian time in the Indian Ocean started 1 year later, but it has it also had a very great impact. You can imagine, you won't believe me if I tell you that there were no Chilis before the Portuguese and the Spanish came to the Indian Ocean. Imagine your cuisine, your food culture without the tomato, without the potato. All these things came when Columbus crossed the Atlantic and came back. Some of these things had already been brought to West Africa by the West Africans. When Columbus came to the West Indies, he actually found black people and some people who were a mixture of black Africans and American Indians. But of course, he would not accept that. It was something marginal for him because he was in India, he believed, and so on. The Columbian Exchange caused such drastic changes in the world very quickly at that time. It made Europe extremely rich because they came across wealth which was unused when the American Indian population was decimated, and there were tons and tons actually of gold and silver to be brought to Europe for which they had not worked for. And then the African slave trade was developed, which means they could get free labor and so on. One reason why we claim that the cities of the Indian subcontinent, they are not of slave origin, is just this, the question of free labor. In the Indian subcontinent, there is a system of caste. Casteism has always provided free or cheap labor, which can be inherited. So why should India bring expensive slaves from Africa? It doesn't make sense. Instead, soldiers were brought to protect the different rulers, and which continued even after the Europeans came. They started bringing more and more Africans in from one African colony to another African colony, which came later, but primarily they brought Africans to the Asian colonies. They also, the British brought also African policemen and soldiers to the West Indies, to Jamaica, Bahamas, Bermudas, to British Guiana, long after slavery and slave trade were abolished, because they did not want to recruit soldiers and policemen from the local population. They wanted policemen who could be neutral, who could be loyal to them. So whole battalions were taken from southern Tanzania. One of my students, who is from Jamaica, remembered some lullabies which sounded like Swahili. After she had learned Swahili, then she recognized some sound, some words. She said, "Ah, I know some songs from my childhood. These words appear in that song, in those songs." And that is how we started looking into it. And then, of course, there is documentary evidence that the British had recruited a lot of policemen. Within Africa, within East Africa, they had Ugandan, Kenyan policemen and soldiers in Tanganyika, Tanganyikans in Uganda, and so on. In Zanzibar, we had the whole police force, which was a mixture of people coming from Kenya, Uganda, and Tanzania. Very few would be Zanzibaris themselves. I was telling Khatija here today, for example, the so-called Arab invasion of East Africa, 1822, was not Arab. There was not a single Arab in the fleet. It was a fleet which was leased from Iran. And there were so-called Iranians. Among those so-called Iranians, there were a lot of Indians, including my ancestors. One of my ancestors, he became chief of the bodyguard of the Sultan. And that is how I am proud to call myself a seventh generation born in Zanzibar. We had Sindhi policemen in Zanzibar before the British police force was founded in 1890. And the Sindhi police force continued until it dwindled away. And there is a photograph also from 1914 of what we call a Sindhi Kali, which means a ferocious Sindhi, who didn't use a gun, they used a sword as their weapon. There is a document I mentioned to Khatija also today, about an hour ago. The British, who was in charge, the officer who was in charge of developing the police force in Zanzibar 1891, he had written a letter to London asking permission to recruit foreigners to join the police force in Zanzibar, which ultimately led to the overthrow of the government in 1964, January, 50 years ago, our so-called revolution, when the Republican Revolution. Because out of 1,000 policemen in Zanzibar, 640 were foreigners in January 1964, we are talking about. I have met people of my age, some of them are my colleagues, some I studied with, from West Africa. From Namibia, from Ghana, from Nigeria, whose fathers had been policemen in East Africa, and South Africa. Barack Obama's grandfather from Kenya was a policeman in Zanzibar. He was Catholic, he married a Muslim wife, so he became Muslim. That is how Barack Obama's father is called Hussein, who was born as a Muslim. This is the connection. But there were not that many before the coming of the colonial administrations which needed foreigners in their police force. This is typical. They did it in India also, actually. They would take Punjabis to Bengal. They would take Bengalis to Gujarat. They would take Gujaratis to Tamil Nadu and so on as battalions. To effectively rule the different areas. All these countries never developed a political empire as such. They were countries, many of them were simply city-states. And many times they were at war with one another also, especially after the coming of the Europeans, because they were sort of placed against one another. Some were with the Portuguese, some would be against the Portuguese, similarly with the French and so on. One thing was common, that because of the religion, they were somehow recognizing the Khalifa in Mecca. Since there was no major power anywhere in the Indian Ocean, which commanded their respect, one can say, or military power. Even after the coming of the Europeans, they were still looking towards the Ottoman ruler in Istanbul. We have a poem in Swahili in which the word Sitambuli is used, Now, Sitambuli can mean two things. It means Istanbul, or it can mean the verbal phrase, I do not recognize. There is always a pun in the poetical language in many cultures, and Swahili is typical. A lot of political messages are given in poetry like that. So the guy is writing about Sitambuli as if he's talking about Istanbul and the ruler of Istanbul. Actually, he's telling that he does not recognize the European Christian. That's what he's saying in his poem. We did not have the term globalization until very recently, but the phenomena was there, according to our working definition that I gave you here. And there was no one political leader, one political power or anything, except that the respect was given to the Khalifa there. And now and then, some decree may be brought from place far away in Asia for the East Africans. For example, this is much later, I have one documented evidence. The Khoja Shias had asked whether one can eat seafood. It was halal or haram. And this was in 1927. And it was sent to Najaf in Iran. And one Ayatollah gave the answer, yes. The question has to be asked in such a way so that the answer can be yes or no. That is how a fatwa actually works. So the question was, is it halal to eat seafood, shrimps especially? And the answer was yes. Shrimps are called kamba in East Africa, which is from Arabic. Kanba with an n in front of b is called mb, so it's kamba. But it comes from Persian, so I was really surprised why the Shia in East Africa are asking for a fatwa about shrimps, when shrimps had been consumed even before the coming of Islam. And they spread all the way with the Muslims going to North Africa and into Iberia. In Portuguese and Spanish, shrimps are called gamba. You see? From the same word. It has that etymology. So there are all these different aspects of globalization before the coming of the Europeans in the Indian Ocean, which was intensified terribly after the coming of the Portuguese and the Spanish. It went further in the Atlantic also. They took the horse, for example, to North America. And it changed the lifestyle of the American Indians completely. They became horse riders. And their hunting techniques and access to food and everything changed. New food types brought to the Indian Ocean changed also the economies, the eating habits, the wealth or the poverty of all these areas. And today we have other aspects of globalization, especially through information technology and the exchange of goods. It has to do primarily with the exchange of goods and introduction of new goods, especially food items, because that is the basis of all the economies. Yeah, I think I should stop here, and you can ask questions and comments, and thereby maybe I can give you more information. Because as I wrote to you, my lecture is 15 pages long, and I have no intention of reading it. And the summary I made is 4 pages. And even to read 4 pages, I wouldn't like. I'd rather make a summary of those 4 pages in 15, 20 minutes, maximum half an hour, and have more participation from you instead. Yeah. Yes?
Would you say that Islam went to East Africa and coastal India and then onwards to Malaysia and Philippines? So maybe was it through the traders and it's So it was adopted as a convenience or free will, or was there any?
Actually, in the Indian Ocean, there was no conquest.
No conquest.
Nowhere. The only conquest came much, much later among the peoples of the Indian Ocean themselves. And that is the invasion of East Africa, 1822. When the coast of East Africa, from Mogadishu all the way to the border of Tanzania and Mozambique, it was freed and taken over. It was freed first in 1652. That was the first invasion of the Omanis to push the Portuguese out. And then the Omanis ruled indirectly, and there were many Omani families who became Africanized, like the Mazruis of Kenya. Professor Mazrui, who died last week, he was from that family. Then they became independent. They stopped talking Arabic. Swahili became their mother tongue. So our so-called Arabs of East Africa don't speak Arabic at home. They are not Arabs by definition. You see? Since they don't speak Arabic at home. But by another definition, because they follow the patriline, their male ancestors came from Arabia. Or maybe some of them looked so Negroid, so they've taken that genealogy. They may have just one drop of Arab blood, we don't know. A lot of them have Indian blood also. Indians were settled in South Africa before Christ, South Indians particularly. And there is a new survey conducted recently which has shown that there is a lot of Bantu blood and other African blood among South Indians. Maybe a third of the South Indians have African blood. Earlier this month, in the conference, in the lecture, I think, in the evening, there was one young lady from Tamil Nadu. She looks very Negroid. And she herself said that many people have come to her and asked her where in Africa she comes from, or if she has any African descent. And she says, no, I am a pure Tamil. Yeah. She's working on a PhD about French literature in the West Indies among the people of African descent. Yeah, the monsoon winds did not start blowing after the Europeans came. We know that they've been blowing for thousands of years, if not millions. And Africans were not passive and only recipients. They were active participants with the trade. So they were coming to India and settling, just as Indians were coming to South Africa and settling. Even those Indians who came to South Africa with the British, a lot of them have disappeared in the population because they were men to start with, and many of them had Zulu wives, but their children married Zulus, so they became Zulus. And in the physiognomy, you don't see the Indian in them. But their DNA shows that they are Indian descendants on the factory line. A lot of them, all along the coast, it is like that. Of course, the Indians in East Africa came in large numbers after the coming of the British, to start with the building of the railway, and then the army, the British in the army, First World War, and then the army, very little of the army, Second World War. But after the Second World War, the state expanded, and the British brought a lot of educated men and women to run the schools, new schools, hospitals, and there were architects, there were engineers, all kinds of people. And individuals came on their own also from different parts of especially Gujarat and Punjab, joining their relatives and so on. The trend continues. Today there are more Indians coming as experts, IT experts and all that, and many, many more coming from South India, not North India.
But the bulk of the Indians in East Africa say they are North Indians. And they are more so-called Gujaratis than Punjabis. But the largest number is actually Kutchis, and they are the oldest. We have a survey from 1970-71, a language survey of Tanzania, which showed that 13% of the so-called Indians, Asians, they spoke Swahili at home. But they were mostly Muslims, almost all of them. One here and one there would be Hindu, who had married an African wife or a Swahili Muslim wife. So they would have Swahili at home. A lot of Hindu men, when they became, when they lost their wives, then they took a new wife who was an African. And sometimes they, in practice, became Muslims because they married a Muslim wife. Some of them had two wives, one Hindu, one Muslim. And I know some families, the children would go, the girls would go with the mother to the mandir with the Hindu wife, and the boys would go with the father to the mosque and things like that. Sometimes it would be some Parsi, some Goans, and so on. In along the coast, because it was a high concentration of Muslims who are already a mixture of people from all around the Indian Ocean. So it's not difficult for a man, a single man or a widower, to marry a Muslim wife and become Muslim in practice. He doesn't have to change name or anything like that. He doesn't have to change anything really. He just has to show his face in the mosque now and then when there is a funeral or a wedding, which he would do anyway. Because as I have grown up, Hindus and Muslims, they were together. I went to a Hindu Union primary school in the first years. My sisters went to a Kanyashara, a Gujarati Kanyashara, where 90% were Muslims, Hindus. And in the Hindu Union school, half the teachers are Muslim. So religion for us was a very personal affair. Our compound was big. Next to us were 8 Hindu families. Their weddings were taking place in our home. And the bridal couple was sleeping in our home. You see, we had extra rooms downstairs for the guests. So you can imagine how it was at that time. And the few Christians who were there also, we had integrated schools. They were not segregated in any way. This was the case all around the ocean. It was after the coming of the colonial administration. They encouraged communal segregated schools and things like that. And then they brought the Gujarati language. The British used Gujarati as the international overseas Indian language. So a lot of people who are not Gujarati speakers had to learn Gujarati. And they became literate in Gujarati. So I am mixing so many things here, jumping away from globalization anyway.
I had a question on
yes?
the pre-Islamic periods. I mean, if you're looking at what you said, the DNA evidence or the physical evidence, what is the earliest exchange that is marked by
in the pre-Islamic?
The oldest.
We have some written documents. The earliest is from the year 80 after Christ. The Periplus of the Eritrean Sea, it is called. Eritrean means the Red Sea. It's written in Greek by a Greek sailor. He mentions some spices and then horn, rhinoceros horn, ivory, and also that there are some slaves also brought from there. There was international slave trade because every society had its own slaves. The Greeks were enslaving the Greeks, Arabs were enslaving Arabs, Romans were enslaving Romans, and some slaves were being brought from other countries also. But we are talking about this Mediterranean Oriental slavery. It is very different from the European one. A slave would be a slave for a few years, then he would be free. He would do the job which is his profession, he would earn his own money, and he can buy his freedom. This was impossible in the Western European slavery. So there were slaves also brought from Africa, but very few of them. Even in Goa, I've seen documents in the archives, the state archives of Panjim. Some ships would have 5 slaves, 10 slaves, youngsters, mostly to be employed in the as domestic labor in the large Portuguese homes, which would have their own garden also for growing vegetables and all that. And those homes which have surplus vegetables and fruits would be sold in the market. And it would be the so-called slave who would be going to the market to slave. This was an interesting detail I got on this one. Quite a few things have been written in, they have a paper called Pura Bilek Pura Takwa. There were some very prominent researchers in Goa who have gone through all the Portuguese documents and given statistics also. I don't know if I've answered your question. Yeah. There were hides, there were some spices, rhinoceros, used as a kind of aphrodisiac already at that time, or for making the kanjel, which they would wear here, and ivory, and gold was a bigger item. Things brought from Asia, mostly from India, would be iron, metal things, and brass, copper. Copper was brought from the interior, but later. That's why you needed slaves to carry copper. And then copper would be turned into wire and then taken back to the interior. And different kinds of jewelry would be made from copper wire.
In fact, you mentioned silver, you know, brought by Romans to India. Whereas India, of course, also records the oldest silver and zinc mine.
They were bringing silver coins in sacks. There were no boxes in those days. Sacks of silver, hundreds of sacks in each ship. And then they would buy all kinds of things from India because India was producing everything, especially cloth and utensils and all that, copper and brass, quite much. Utensils for kitchen and things like that. Also wood from India, perfumes and so on. They were the major export items, the Romans, the Greeks. The Greeks and the Romans were buying from India. The same things were being brought by the Arabs also. The Arabs were bringing other things from Africa and the Middle East. So, when they are the same things being mentioned in all those documents, from the earliest to much later. But in European documents, then we find that they give more and more importance to slaves as a metal item, which is not true. Because the French mentioned themselves that they were taking more, twice as many slaves as the Arabs from Kilwa, from the south of Tanzania. The same Kilwa we are talking about. And those slaves did not come from East Africa. They were brought all the way from Congo by different African slave traders, and particularly the chiefs. They were raiding smaller tribes or distant tribes and bring the slaves to the captives to the coast and then sell them directly to the Europeans. Arabs or we Zanzibaris were not involved in this at all, but we are being given off the plane. Figures have been suggested, figures that are very commonly quoted now is Carl Sagan's 40 million Africans were forcefully taken from the continent. Others have suggested 100 million. Farrakhan says 600 million. No. The whole population of the whole world was not 600 million at that time, at the beginning of the up to the middle of the 1800s. David Livingstone has suggested 50,000 slaves passing through the market in Zanzibar. Impossible. It cannot be. He collected figures for 2 or 3 days, he said, in the market, and he made an average of it, multiplied by 365. Not taking into account that half the year the market was closed. During the monsoon, when it rains, the market is closed. So you cannot include those days in your calculation. All holidays, for example, Thursday and Friday will be closed. Half the year there won't be any ships coming. So there is no market. It would be the same slaves, no, which are already there, which would be sold. But why would somebody sell slaves that he owns? Unless he's going bankrupt or something like that. Unless his project has come to an end, building a house or clearing the forest. But he doesn't need to buy slaves and own them to clear the forest and build a house. He can hire them. Now this thing has been completely missed by the Europeans. Hiring a slave, no. Something new for them, even today. So most of the slaves, maybe you would find in the slave market of Zanzibar, towards the end of the 1800s, they were for hire. The slaves which were not sold today may be brought tomorrow again for sale. Those who are not hired today will be brought tomorrow. Or those who are hired today, after 2 or 3 days' job, with one person, will be brought again to the market for some other job. Slaves would be coming to the market on their own when they are free. Now, how can a slave be free? Our slaves were free 3 days a week. They worked 3 days a week. 2 days were holidays, and 2 days they were free. So when they are free, they can do their own work. So they would also go to the market looking for a job and hire themselves. All these were counted by David Livingstone as the average of those 3 days multiplied by 365. And we get 50,000. So where would 50,000 people sleep even today? I mean, we are talking about 150 years ago. So these are all lies, you know, or falsification of history. And a lot of history has been falsified by the colonialists, which we have to rewrite. We are trying to rewrite it. UNESCO had the project of African History Project, if some of you know, from 1974. And 8 volumes have been written. And all kinds of Africans and Westerners have been involved in this also. And that is the most reliable history of Africa, one can say. But you cannot write the history of a whole continent in only 8 volumes. We need to write maybe 80 volumes and so on. But more research is being done and more correct information is brought forth. There are lots of sources in India. There are 2 books published in India about 40 years ago, I think. One is only this thin, 200 pages. One is this thick, 600-700 pages. It's a catalogue of sources on Africa in India. So the thin one is all the sources. Of course, as far back we go, there are fewer sources. And the thick one is after the coming of the British. So we have many, many more documents. And there would be documents in the local Indian languages which nobody has done any work on. For example, I know that there are some handwritten manuscripts in the archive of Butch about the cities of Kutch. Yeah. There are some documents Leif Manger had collected, the anthropologist from Norway, about the cities of Hyderabad, which is written in Urdu, which I have seen myself, which the Norwegians wanted to translate into English. I don't know how far they have gone with it. So there are documents like this, written by the cities themselves, for example. And so
more information will come out through such sources. I don't know, since I have not read any paper and I have not held myself to one red thread throughout, if I have dealt with this topic in any fruitful way. Have you got some idea or a picture of globalization in the Indian Ocean? The early globalization. And the Indian Ocean world, the Indian Ocean had its own civilization, which was a string of cultures, we say. A string of cultures with these three or four common denominators, that it was Muslim, it was trade, it was the Arabic language, Arabic architecture, or a combination of so-called Muslim architecture, I should say, because all of them have contributed. And the food culture. You find the same dishes, biryani, samosa, pilau, all kinds of this sabzi you have, all these things. And we are a rice culture. We have 10, 15 names for rice. And we have one common way of cooking rice, that is with the coconut milk. You use water if you don't get coconut milk. Otherwise you make your rice, boiling the rice with coconut milk. Unless you make biryani in pilau, then you don't use coconut milk in that. Ibn Battuta is mentioning actually that he was invited to a dish of bananas cooked in milk in February 1332.
So
it is an old dish, this one. We have it even today. Once or twice a month we make it, cooking bananas in coconut milk. Of course he did not mention coconut, he just said milk. Yeah?
So both pulao and samosa, both of them are Central Asian origin. Because pulao,
And we say sambusa, well, that's the original word. Sambusa, we call sambusa. Samosa is the Indian version, and I think it came with the British. They always do something with our languages. the sambusa was taken all the way to Spain. One of the writers from Spain, he mentions at a wedding, 1200 something, that samosa was served at a wedding party. And Muslims and the Jews who had become Christian to avoid being hanged or killed or whatever it is, and then they went to Argentina, they took the samosa with them. And they are using samosa even today at the wedding parties. Yeah. And it is called sambusa, the original pronunciation. Yeah.
Thank you, Dr. Nodi. Now we can go for tea, which is the next room. So, yeah, we can continue the question and answer session over the next room.
After I have thanked everybody.
Yes.
Thank you very much for listening and giving me this time. And I hope some other. I am coming back end of January. I am leaving day after tomorrow, but I'll come back, and I will stay in Delhi for 3 more months. So I hope I get one more chance to come and talk about something and tell you some of my stories. Yeah.